This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, Ross Freeman Levin interviews Pete Stauffer, Oceans Programs Manager for the Surfrider Foundation, about the work they do and their upcoming summer soiree. At 9:30, economist Richard Wolff speaks with Dr. Obery Hendricks Jr., professor of religion and biblical studies, about how the Bible contradicts conservatives' interpretations. At 10 o'clock here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints. Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill recorded at the recent Socialism Conference and a look at the inside story of the Pentagon Papers. And at 11, it's the Recovery Zone with your host, Stephanie Potter.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor What the Festival, July 26th through 28th, 2013, at Wolf Run Ranch in Oregon. Featuring over 50 electronic and dance artists, including Purity Ring, A-Track, RJD2, and Tycho, as well as on-site art installations, a hookah lounge, and splash pool. That's July 26th through 28th, 2013, at Wolf Run Ranch in Oregon. Tickets on sale now at whatthefestival.com.
Black men are under attack by the U.S. justice system. From the demonstrations around the verdict in the Trayvon Martin murder to the Pelican Bay prison hunger strike, the struggle is heating up again. Join that struggle. Herman Wallace of the Angola 3 needs your help. A Black Panther prison organizer, framed for a crime he did not commit, locked in solitary confinement for over 40 years, he now faces death in the same 8x6 cell he's had to live in. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, on a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. Robert King, the only freed member of the Angola 3, will join me. He'll bring us up to date on the case and ask you to join Amnesty International in demanding an immediate, compassionate release for Herman Wallace. That's Save Herman Wallace on a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO Community Radio.
Are you ready to head to the beach with KBOO and Surfrider Portland? This is Political Perspectives for Wednesday, July 24th. This is Ross Freeman Levin for KBOO Portland, and today I'm talking with Pete Stauffer from Surfrider, and we are talking about a great event coming up Thursday, July 25th.
That's right, yeah.
At Holocene. Before we get into your event, people in Portland might not know what Surfrider is about, so why don't you tell us what Surfrider does?
So the Surfrider Foundation is a grassroots environmental organization. We work on a range of ocean and coastal conservation issues. And Surfrider was actually started by a bunch of surfers in Malibu, California. This was over 25 years ago. And these surfers were concerned because their local surfing break was being threatened. So they decided to organize and essentially protect their local resource. So, you know, that was the beginning of Surfrider, and in less than 30 years, it's gone on to become this sort of international organization. We have chapters and members across the country, including an active chapter here in Portland, but the concept's the same. You know, it's basically people protecting what they love.
Does your work extend beyond the ocean beach interface zone? You've sort of spearheaded in different places like Portland on banning plastic bags.
Yeah, sure. Well, generally, Surfrider is ocean and coastal conservation, and we're grassroots and volunteer driven. So the work that we do, it tends to be very local. So one of the issues we've worked on here in Portland is banning single-use plastic bags. Plastic bags are really bad for the environment. They don't biodegrade. They cause all kinds of problems when they get in the rivers and the oceans. And so it's just a no-brainer for people to use reusable bags. So we worked with a number of partners, a number of other groups and businesses in Portland to get Portland to pass a ban on single-use plastic grocery bags. So that was a big win for us and certainly one of the things we're known for here in Portland.
So maybe you can tell us, are you a surfer yourself? I'm guessing.
I am. I'm a longtime surfer, but you don't have to be a surfer to be involved with Surfrider. You know, it is sort of our cultural identity, but you know, I think the main sort of common denominator is people that love the coast, who love the rivers, who care about the watersheds, and just want to volunteer. And the great thing about Surfrider is there's so many different ways to get involved. You know, you can get involved with cleanup events. You can help maintain the website or social media. You can do event planning. So it's very organic and very sort of bottom up.
Ballpark, how many people in the Portland area are active in your Portland chapter of Surfrider?
You know, I would say we probably have about 50 to 75 core volunteers and people who just give so much time and help support, you know, all of our different programs and events and campaigns. But we're always trying to grow that. You know, the more volunteers we have, the more that we can do. So certainly that's one of the goals for the event coming up on July 25th. Is not just raising money to support our clean water campaign, but attracting new volunteers and new members.
So really the focus of your ongoing efforts are toward clean beaches and clean water and safe access to coastal and water recreation, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. So here in Portland, we do a number of cleanups and restoration events. We work really closely with Portland Parks and Recreation. So the Oaks Bottom Natural Area, for example, we've done a number of cleanups, you know, removing trash, removing invasive species, planting native plants. And it's really cool to see these natural areas sort of transform. And, you know, of course, the city agencies, they have limited staff and resources. So they really count on partnerships with volunteer groups. So, you know, these cleanups, we may have 25 or 30 people show up, which is great, but, you know, we'd love to double that.
Great. So the summer soiree is one of your sort of promotional events. Let's dig into when that's happening and who's going to be there, because it sounds like there's going to be great music, great art.
It's
kind of a great community event.
We are so stoked. So our Surfrider soiree, it's coming up on Thursday, July 25th. We're holding it at the Holocene, which is located in Southeast Portland, 1001 Southeast Morrison. The event begins at 6 p.m. We're going to start off with an art show with ocean-themed and surfing-related art that you can bid on. Surfing art, and that art will be for sale. Proceeds supporting, of course, the Portland Surfrider chapter. We're going to have great live music from the Renegade String Band, a local band. They are awesome. They play kind of hard-driving bluegrass. Sort of a mix of their own tunes, but they also do a lot of cover tunes, bands like the Black Keys, and put a great spin on some of those songs. And their lead singer, Jessica Jarris, is unbelievable. We're going to have a surf film, The Heart in the Sea, produced by Tom Oldfield. Great surf film, lots of prizes and silent auction items to bid on. We have a raffle with tons of gear, all kinds of prizes. And we've gotten just unbelievable support from our sponsors. Big thanks to our sponsors, including Dick's Sporting Goods, our title sponsor. There is a $10 fee to get into the event, but all the proceeds from the event support the Portland chapter of the Surfrider Foundation and our clean water program here in Portland.
Sounds like it's going to be a fun event.
It will be a blast, so we hope to see you there.
Why don't you tell people what all they can find on your website and how to find your website?
Yeah, so our website is portland.surfrider.org. That's our website for the chapter. And if you want information on the summer soiree event, on the right side, you'll see a very cool poster. You just click on that. You get all the information. But also on the website, you have information on our event calendar. So if you want to come out for, say, a cleanup event or get involved in our Green Streets team or learn how to volunteer, all that information is on the website.
And some of our listeners aren't in the Portland area. I assume there are links out to other surf rider resources. So someone, say, in Southern Oregon who's listening, or on the North Coast in Washington, or anywhere else in the United States, they probably can find a link to their local Surfrider chapter and figure out a way to get engaged.
Absolutely. Yeah, Surfrider has over 85 chapters across the country. And actually, if you want to access our national page, it's just surfrider.org. Very easy to remember. But yeah, here in the state of Oregon, we have four chapters. So a chapter in Portland. We also have chapters in Newport and Florence and Coos Bay. Yeah, just a range of different kinds of activities that we do across the state.
.org. I'm guessing Surfrider's a 501.
We are, yeah, 501c3, a nonprofit organization, volunteer-driven. You know, some of our other programs I'd like to talk about. We have a volunteer water quality testing program. So our Portland chapter, we actually maintain a water quality lab in Manzanita on the North Coast. So a lot of surfers and other Surfrider members in Portland, you know, we love to go to the North Coast to hang out on the beach or surf. And so this program is basically a way to sample water quality and make sure that the water that we're recreating in is safe. And so it's one of five different water quality labs that we have on the Oregon coast.
So you have five labs at your disposal, or do you actually maintain those labs as an organization?
Yeah, so Surfrider maintains those labs. So, you know, in terms of fundraising, that's a big thing that the fundraiser will support is the lab equipment, testing supplies. We monitor water quality at, you know, literally dozens of sites up and down the Oregon coast. We also work very closely with the state of Oregon. They have their own water quality testing program called the Oregon Beach Monitoring Program. Great program. And because resources are limited all the way around, we sort of work with them to help fill the gaps. Or, you know, in many cases, let's say we identify a place where there's chronic pollution problems, you know, we'll let the state know, and, you know, then they can start testing, and maybe we can work with the local community to try and source that pollution and clean up the problem.
Maybe you can just give a snapshot of what you're finding in the water. What is it you're actually finding when you're testing the water?
We test for bacteria, which is actually recommended by the EPA as being the best indicator for ocean-borne illness. Certainly, it's driven by public health concerns. And so that's an indicator. So if you start to get high readings for what's called enterococcus, that means that there's an elevated risk for sickness. And so it's the same parameter that the state monitors through their program.
So you're contributing to both state and local agencies, supporting them through your volunteer efforts. And it sounds like that's nationwide.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we love to partner as an organization. We're very collaborative, you know, whether it be supporting implementation of marine reserves or sampling water quality or cleaning up public parks. You know, I think that's sort of a growing trend across the country is, you know, resources for government agencies are limited. So they love working with volunteer groups, and they love sort of promoting stewardship and positive engagement from just regular people.
Now, from in the Wayback Machine, I actually got to have a conversation 20 years ago with Dick Dale
about
the surfer's itch. And I wonder if he or any other significant figures in surfing culture helped to contribute to the starting of Surfrider. Like, who and what was at the kernel of your founding? And are they still active in your organization? Is that something that's been sustained by long-term membership and participation?
Yeah. You know, we've gotten just terrific support over the years from professional surfers and the surfing industry. You know, one person, a famous surfer you may have heard of, Sean Thompson, I believe he's originally from South Africa, but, you know, won the world title a number of times. And he was sort of one of the original supporters of Surfrider, and in fact, is still on our national board of directors. So, you know, having support from people like him, people like Kelly Slater, who's, you know, probably the most famous and best surfer in the world. You know, it's terrific to have that kind of support from them.
It sounds like there's a lot on your plate, a lot of things to pay attention to, and you got people here in the city working on that water quality, clean water, other efforts that are happening in the state and local level that Surfrider is supporting. Maybe you can highlight some of those.
Yeah. So another thing we do with our Portland chapter is we have a Green Streets team. This is part of a citywide program, but essentially we have a crew of volunteers that goes out once a month, and we clean out bioswales. If you don't know what a bioswale is, if you're walking along the sidewalk in Portland, you may see these sort of small gardens that are being installed. Those are designed to collect and treat stormwater. So, of course, when it rains and the stormwater, it picks up pollution. You know, instead of that water getting funneled into the river, it's directed into these bioswales, and then it can filter out the pollutants, filter out debris. So the city has been installing these all across the city, but in terms of maintaining them, they really depend on volunteer support. So we have a Green Streets team. It's tons of fun. We go out once a month for a couple hours, basically just clean out these bioswales, and we have a great time doing it. It's a lot of fun. We have a crew of about 8 or 10 really dedicated people, but you know, that's another goal of the event, is trying to maybe double or triple that, get our Green Streets team, you know, maybe even make it into 2 teams, because I know the city would tell you that it can really benefit from volunteer support.
We actually see one of those bioswales right out on Burnside around the corner from the KBOO studio, and I'm sure you folks have swept by and helped keep that clean, the one out in front of the hotel next door.
Yeah, yeah. And they do, you know, they accumulate trash and debris, you know, pretty regularly. So they do need to be maintained.
And you announce those, you call it Green Streets?
Yeah, it's the Green Streets team. And actually the city of Portland, if you visit their website, the Bureau of Environmental Services, you can read about the Green Streets program. And so our team essentially participates in that city program.
And do you announce those things on your social media, like Facebook or Twitter or any of the other social media sites? Or do you maintain like a mailing list internally, so you just send out emails? How do you communicate with your members?
Yeah, a number of ways. We do have a Facebook page, which is a great way just to get plugged in and just search for Portland Surfrider. You can like us or become a fan, and you know, we usually post updates a couple times a week, you know, on our meetings, our volunteer opportunities, those kinds of things. We also have an email newsletter that we limit to about 2 emails per month. And you can sign up for that right on our website. So go to portland.surfrider.org and you can sign right up, and you'll get sort of local happenings here in Portland, how to volunteer, how to get involved. But also information about, you know, different kinds of issues happening at the state level.
So legislative efforts or anything that's happening environmentally that impacts the surfing community, you guys stay pretty much abreast of that and share it with your followers and members.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're very involved. One of the issues we've worked on at the state level is marine reserves. Marine reserves are places in the ocean that are protected. So they're protected from fishing pressure or development projects or ocean dumping. And it turns out when you take a place in the ocean and you protect it, the marine ecosystem will respond. So over time, you'll see more fish, greater numbers of invertebrates, greater levels of biodiversity. So this really powerful tool to sort of protect our marine ecosystem. The state of Oregon has had this long planning process, over a decade long, essentially to designate these marine reserve sites off the Oregon coast. And our members have been really involved in that process. It really was sort of a public, community-driven process to sort of figure out, well, where should these reserves go? You know, how do we minimize impacts on ocean users and fishermen? And so just recently, the state finalized the locations for 5 different marine reserves off the Oregon coast. Surfrider's really involved in supporting implementation. There's a public process to create the management plans. There's all kinds of citizen science opportunities to go out with the state scientists and count the fish and do other kinds of surveys, and also do different kinds of educational programs with the schools and just outreach to other ocean users about the rules. So, you know, this is really kind of a historic thing. You know, we think about Oregon's legacy with, you know, land use planning and being one of these really forward-thinking states. Same kind of idea, you know, in terms of taking that concept to the ocean. And really these reserves, you know, the idea is to make sure they're embraced by the community, embraced by ocean users, and they're going to provide a backbone of protection for our marine environment for future generations.
And I'm imagining that there are probably listeners in the KBOO audience who, like myself, may have surfed in the past. Full disclosure, I did surf out at Florence a couple times and absolutely loved it. But
yeah,
at the same time, there are environmental conditions or physical limitations that might keep someone out of the water. But it sounds like scientists in the form of, you know, biologists or water quality or any kind of person with an interest in healthy oceans and recreation around that, even if they can't personally participate, they have an interest and might be able to plug in with Surfrider as a supporting member, even if they don't surf.
Absolutely. You know, most of our members and volunteers actually aren't surfers. You know, they're just people who love the coast, who love our local rivers and watersheds and want to get involved. And, you know, there's so many different ways, you know, whether it's participating in a cleanup or, you know, just becoming a member of Surfrider Foundation. We are a member-based organization. So for $25, you just go to surfrider.org and you can sign up to become a member. And that funding doesn't just support the national organization. Some of those funds actually support the local chapter. You know, one of the things we try and do as an organization is have a voice in policy discussions. So the more members we have, the larger our base. So the more influence we can have to protect our ocean and coastal environment.
It sounds like you're doing some lobbying at the local, state, and national level.
We do. I mean, decisions get made all the time that affect our coast and ocean and our watersheds. And so one of the things we do as a grassroots organization is communicate with decision makers. One of the things we worked on just here in Portland was the city council was making some very tough decisions about what to fund in this year's budget. And initially in the mayor's budget, funding for the Community Watershed Stewardship Program was not included. A great, great program that sort of brings partners together to, you know, protect watershed health, build capacity. And, you know, our members were very active in submitting comments to the city, attending some of these budget hearings, and we were able to get that funding restored for that program.
So just right here on the local level, you feel an impact. How about on the state level? You said the habitat preserves are a big one.
You know, we tend to work it on issues where we have local chapters, but we do engage in national legislation. So, you know, we have this network of 85 chapters across the country. And what we do every year, based on feedback from our chapters, is we pick a small number of national bills in Congress that really we want to get behind as an organization and try and support. So, for example, federal funding for water quality monitoring, that's a huge priority for us right now. And in fact, some of that funding for years has come to Oregon to support that Oregon Beach Monitoring Program. So, you know, that's a good example of how, you know, Surfrider members across the country will maybe, you know, contact their congressmen and women, you know, try and influence decisions at the national level. But then that comes back and you know, affects us here locally in terms of, you know, better monitoring for water quality or, you know, better legislation to protect our environment.
The soiree is a party to celebrate all that great energy, all that togetherness, a great opportunity to network and promote yourselves and build your membership. So let's make sure we repeat all that great stuff that's going to happen at the soiree Thursday.
Yeah, so the Surfrider Soiree, it's coming up next Thursday, July 25th at the Holocene in Southeast Portland. The event begins at 6 p.m. We're going to have an art show with ocean-themed and surfing-themed art, artists from across the Pacific Northwest, great live music from the Renegade String Band. We've got tons of prizes and silent auction items. And yes, it is a fundraiser for our Portland chapter. to support our clean water program.
But if people are going to miss that event, are there going to be other upcoming events that you want to look ahead to? And maybe what's next after the soiree?
You know, we're constantly doing different kinds of events. If you want to get involved, probably the best thing to do is come to a chapter meeting. We have monthly chapter meetings. They're the second Tuesday of every month, and we hold them at the Southeast Lucky Lab at 7:30. And they're 90 minutes, and you know, we sort of do a review of our different programs and campaigns and volunteer opportunities. We usually have a guest speaker, which is usually great. And it's just great people. You know, one thing about Surf Rider is we're very committed to what we do, but we have a great time doing it. And, you know, our mission is both protection and enjoyment of oceans, waves, and beaches. So it's a lot of fun as well. So
do you have a 1-year, 5-year, 10-year plan? Or are you looking at taking on even larger issues? Or is there something in the future that we're looking ahead to, or you're looking ahead to, mm-hmm. that people might want to get tapped into now that's going to be happening on an upcoming basis?
Yeah. You know, I think our big priorities in the Portland chapter, one is continuing to grow our Green Streets program, getting new volunteers for that. Another project that we're going to be initiating in the coming year is installing a large rain garden at Peninsula School, which is a school in North Portland. So be a collaboration between the school and the students and the teachers. And we're looking for support with that. Then, of course, at the statewide level, just supporting the management plan development for these new marine reserves and getting people involved in citizen science and education around that.
So anyone committed to clean beaches, clean water, recreation in that, it sounds like the opportunities are almost limitless for connection and commitment and engagement.
Absolutely. We take all comers. We do lots of great work, and we'd love to have you get involved.
Well, I think we're going to take the opportunity to do a little promotion of the music and play some music from the Renegade String Band. But before I do that, I just want to thank you, Pete, for coming in and sharing all the great things that Surf Rider's doing in Portland and the state of Oregon across the country. It sounds like there's just a whole lot of great energy out there for the things that you're doing.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about Surf Rider, and big thanks to KBOO because you've been just a great supporter for us. So much appreciated.
Well, it's a mutual appreciation society here. So we'll go out with some music from the Renegade String Band. And don't forget Thursday night at Holocene, starting at
6 p.m.
And is there going to be food?
There will be food available, yeah.
See, so
absolutely, yeah.
Great. So people can go hungry and get all that great art, the great music, a raffle, just a great connecting event, and have a meal.
Yep, and great libations as well.
Oh, terrific. All right, well, here's to Surf Rider. Thanks again, Pete.
Thank you.
The wind is blowing across the mountain and down on valley way below. It sweeps the grave of my darling. When I die, that's where I wanna go. Oh Lord, send me angels for my darling and take her to their home on high. I'll wait my time out here on earth, love.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9:28. Coming up next at 9:30, economist Richard Wolff speaks with Dr. Obery Hendricks Jr., professor of religion and biblical studies, about how the Bible contradicts conservatives' interpretations. At 10 o'clock here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill recorded at the recent Socialism Conference, and a look at the inside story of the Pentagon Papers. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter looks at actions taking place in the Pacific Northwest to confront climate crisis with David Osborne of Portland Rising Tide, Tori Cole with 350's PDX Campus Divestment Team, and Bonnie McKinley, who works on climate issues with Power Past Coal, Rising Tide, Greenpeace, 350 PDX, and the Sierra Club. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our one-day flash drive last Friday. If you missed it, you can still contribute. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and The Sound Outside, The Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up, we hear an excerpt from the series Economic Update. Host Richard Wolf speaks with Dr. Aubrey Hendricks Jr., professor of religion and biblical studies, about how the Bible contradicts conservatives' interpretations.
It gives me enormous pleasure now to introduce my guest, Aubrey M. Hendricks Jr. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a personal friend, but you shouldn't hold that against him. He is a former Wall Street investment executive and past president of Payne Theological Seminary, the oldest African-American theological seminary in the United States. Dr. Hendricks is currently a visiting scholar at Columbia University in the Department of Religion and the Institute for Research in African-American Studies. And he's also a professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He holds a Master of Divinity degree with academic honors from Princeton Theological Seminary and both the MA and PhD in Religions of Late Antiquity from Princeton University. He has more degrees than I do, which not that many people do, and he needs a special case to carry them around in case there are skeptics who want to see proof. He has also been featured on C-SPAN, PBS, National Public Radio, BBC. I mean, it goes on. It includes such things as the Fox Business News, Fox News itself, and so on. He is a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post and has two very important books that I urge you to find and read, especially if you find interesting what we talk about today. The first is called The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted, published by Doubleday in 2006. And the other book, The Universe Bends Toward Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic, published in 2011. Aubrey, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Pleasure to be here with you, Rick, as always.
So let me jump right in and begin. In the United States, the Republican Party, and this has counterparts in other countries as well, is a kind of coalition. You might say it's got religious fundamentalists of various kinds in it. It's got major corporations, and it counts the loyalty of the majority of the richest 10% of households in the United States. And one of the ways this coalition of very different forces, if you think about it, holds itself together is the argument that the Christian Bible, and indeed the major books of other religions, endorse capitalism, celebrate capitalism and the wealth distribution and income distribution that capitalism yields for the populations where it is the system. So I wanted to begin by putting a difficult question to Aubrey. Is it your view that the Bible endorses capitalism and its results in modern society? Is that a claim you think is reasonably grounded in the Bible?
No, it's not, and it's not just my opinion either. Capitalism is really based on, they talk about liberty and freedom, which is liberty and freedom from any obstacles to greater wealth accumulation. It says nothing about responsibility, says nothing about moral limits, but the Bible says all of that. I mean, the Bible doesn't stress freedom, it stresses responsibility to one another. We see throughout the Bible that it evinces this concern for the poorest and the weakest, and it enjoins upon its believers to take care of the poorest and the weakest. You see this throughout the Hebrew Bible, and you see it in Jesus' discourses in the New Testament. I mean, Jesus talks more about the poor and about poverty than anything else. other than God. So capitalists, capitalism really, in many ways, is anathema to basic economic philosophy and ethos of the Hebrew Bible and the Gospels.
Give me then your understanding. How has it been possible for the conservative, pro-capitalist forces in our society and in other societies to be able to present to the public the argument that the Bible is on their side, that the Bible endorses, supports, and celebrates capitalism, mm-hmm. wealth accumulation, in the ways that capitalism function? How did they manage that?
Yeah, well, it's come from an old story, really. Go back to 313 or so A.D., with Constantine. Emperor Constantine, he embraced, to some extent, the Christian religion, and at that point was the faith of the oppressed became the religion of the oppressor. And Constantine declared himself the 13th apostle appointed by God, meaning that no one could question him and that he had a direct line to God. And it was at that point that Christianity was brought into congruence and indeed to service to the empire. And since that time, mainstream Christianity has always, I think without exception, has always pushed the dominationist view, the upper class view. You know, we don't have the stratum of the little discourse. We have the stratum of the big discourse where everything is interpreted as being in service to the ruling stratum. Well, not everything, but virtually. It doesn't matter the little bit that isn't. And so that's really, though, of course, a corruption of the biblical witness. And so what we see on the religious right and in endorsing capitalism and endorsing all kinds of oppressions and exploitations in ways that sometimes they don't even understand, we see that's really just a continuation of that trajectory from Emperor Constantine, really in many ways taking over Christianity and in some ways even dictating its trajectory. And one example of that we see with, I believe it's the King James Bible. There's a Bible that was printed, an interpretation that was printed, a translation was printed about 50 years before the King James Bible, which used the term tyrant often. It translated tyrant. Well, it gets the King James Bible, the word tyrant, it's never found because, well, obviously he didn't want the Bible to indict what was going on at the, you know, the despotism that was going on at the time. So this is how they arrive at this unfortunate explanation, because one other thing, there's this ideology of the Bible being the word of God. I mean, there's just one word. You know, like there's no separate books. It's all just one book. And the reason that's significant is because this word of God ideology says that there's essentially what it says, that this is the word of God, and those who sit in the seat of interpretation, they're just speaking for God. But the word of God, this kind of ideology is always, we always find that in the right wing, in the conservative wings, in service to those in power. So these are the major ways that they twist the Bible to be in support of capitalism and other kinds of exploitation.
Am I hearing you correctly then, in my own words, that the Bible of Jesus is the Bible of folks at the bottom, in a sense, of society, trying to think through and develop a religion that speaks to their needs as the bottom? Mm-hmm. And that 300 years after Jesus, a change happens, and the people who run society begin to find a way of interpreting Christianity to serve their interests. So you begin to have a kind of split in which Christianity has at least two kinds of interpretations, mm-hmm. depending on whether you're more aligned with the views of those at the bottom, the Jesus who's concerned mm-hmm. with poverty, mm-hmm. versus those who are interested in a religion that supports the powers that be. Mm-hmm. Am I reading that right?
Yeah. It's, you know, there's something that cultural anthropologists call the little tradition and the big tradition. These these strata of discourse, ideological discourse. And the little tradition is really the tradition that expresses the needs and the aspirations of those below. But not only that, the Gospels, much of the Bible, but particularly the Gospels, are written to those below. I mean, look at the things they talk about. They're all peasant concerns. And Jesus has to say things like, "Blessed are you poor folk." Can you imagine how beaten down they must have been for him to have to say that? Jesus says in Luke 4, which is his paradigmatic initial sermon, Luke tells us, he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he's anointed me to preach good news to the poor, freedom to the oppressed." The acceptable year of the Lord, which we scholars, most scholars, see representing the Jubilee year, when all lands will be returned to their former, their original owners. Why is that significant? Well, land was really the major source of capital, but it also had a lot to do with people's self-concept, their honor. But the other consideration is because that was so very important to people, that no one would voluntarily let go of their land, so they lost it because of debt or fraud or some other consideration. But more importantly, what that is a sort of a, it's not a leveling mechanism, but it serves to keep a permanent wealthy class from developing, like, you know, we have throughout the world now. Certainly we have that here. And it sort of, in some ways, it lessens the gap between income and between poverty and wealth. So, I mean, these are brilliant.
This idea of Jubilee sits in the economics profession. It lurks at the edges of economics. It is an extremely powerful idea. As an economist, I can tell you that. Because what it does is it admits that when you let a modern economy develop on its own, it tends to develop inequality. It makes some people richer and richer and richer and impoverishes others. So that there has to be an intervention to stop this from going to the point of people at each other. You periodically have a year of Jubilee when you redistribute the land and equally distribute it among people again. But that's a recognition that there must be an intervention based on moral, ethical considerations.
Yes.
Because if you leave the economy to itself, it goes in a direction that violates the precepts of moral and ethical life. Yeah. It's a very powerful indictment of economics. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I'm talking with my guest, Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, an expert on the Bible and Christianity, the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted, and also The Universe Bends Toward Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. We were just about to turn to a very important topic, the conservative argument around the world that somehow we are living the good life as per the ethics and morality of the Christian Bible, and indeed other religions' founding works, by having the government play a minimum role. Do very little, be away, leave it, the private sector to itself, that government is somehow negative, even in the world of the Bible. And I want to ask Aubrey, Dr. Hendricks, to tell us whether his understanding of the Bible is consistent with this view of government.
Yeah. No, it's not consistent, and I just want to make clear, it's not just my view. The Bible itself, as I said earlier, never says anything about the size of government. What it does say is government, the responsibilities of government, the purposes of government, and that is to be just, to take care of the poor and the needy, and the government has to, whatever size government needs to be, to effectuate that, that's the size it has to be. If it's a big government, I mean, biblical terms, if you need a big government to do that, then you have to have a big government. But I'd just like to read something from the Psalms, give you an idea of another aspect of it.
Please.
This is the 72nd Psalm. It says, "Give the king thy justice, O God, and thy righteousness," sort of call their righteousness, doing things the right way, "to the king's son. May he judge thy people with righteousness and thy poor with justice. Let the mountains bear prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the people, give deliverance to the needy, and crush the oppressor. For he delivers the needy when he calls, the poor in him who has no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight. So what this essentially says is that it's saying what the ideal ruler is supposed to be, what ideal governance is supposed to be. It's supposed to make sure that things are done in a just way. And biblical justice is egalitarian justice, meaning everybody should have the same rights and same opportunities, same access to the good things in life. It says that, and so if that's the case, then those in governance, in any form of governance, but particularly in governance run by Christians, that governance, that form of governance, has as a primary responsibility to take care of the poor and the needy and to do whatever needs to be done to make sure that is done in justice and righteousness. So that militates against this little government thing, because the smaller the government is, the fewer protections there are for the people. And the Bible shares a number of regulatory protections for the people. For instance, you look in the law codes in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and we see what are really rudimentary regulatory protections for the people. For instance, we see that consistent weights and measures are enjoined so that the poor people will not be cheated and exploited. It talks about workers' wages, treating workers correctly, treating them fairly, pay them their wages when they're made. It also talks about when you essentially fire somebody, when you let them go from your employ, send them out with a good severance, in effect, which, a lot of these corporations need to think about. So,
At the very least.
So to summarize, the Bible says that government has certain responsibilities, and the implications that government has to be as large as it needs to be to fulfill those responsibilities, and that governance, a responsibility of governance, is to make sure that everybody has access to the good things in life, and that's what government must. That is a function that must be performed by government according to the biblical witness. Now, you don't have to do that, obviously, but you can't not do it and talk about you're some kind of, Christian. This is what the Bible says. That's not true. It's absolutely wrong, and it's a lie, and it's in service. Think about who is in service to. Who's in service to. Those who are at the top, the rich folk. We might call that the Koch brothers' Bible,
Instead of the King James.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I want to ask you, in some ways, a really hard question. And not hard because the answer is difficult, but hard because it has been taboo in much of the Western world, certainly in the United States, for at least half a century, to even pose this kind of question. But I'm going to pose it anyway. Is there a biblical basis, a reasonable interpretation of the Bible, that would argue for socialism in some sense and against capitalism? And I'm only interested because I want to explore with you interpretations of the Bible that are different from what people normally think the Bible is, which is an endorser of capitalism. So I want to kind of put the $64 billion question. Do you see a biblical interpretation that supports socialism? And for listeners and viewers who aren't familiar, in many European countries, there's a long tradition of what's called Christian socialism, in which people were socialists who did, in fact, find the basis for their commitment politically in their religion.
And in this country, too.
And in the United States, too.
So
let me ask you now, 2013, is there an interpretation of the Bible that you find that could be so understood as to support a socialism over and against the capitalism?
Yeah, well, in that we're speaking in ethical terms, of course. The Bible talks about responsibility. It talks about everyone having an equal share and equal access. In many places we see a certain kind of what people would call communalism, where folk come together and work together, which, you know, can be understood as a basis for socialism. We also see things like in the Book of Acts, there is a passage in which it says we shared everything in common but our wives. And in the early part of the 20th century, commentators were calling that primitive communism. So what it really comes down to in ethical terms, socialism is concerned about there being more equality, more egalitarianism, economic egalitarianism, fewer obstacles to economic mobility and all that. Then socialism is much more consistent with the biblical witness, biblical ethics, than capitalism, because capitalism is amoral. In fact, you know, they take great pride that they, in their misinterpretation of Adam Smith, in saying that, you know, it doesn't matter what we do, the market will adjudicate everything. Well, that's a form of idolatry. You know, I mean, market's going to take care of everything. We can be as exploitive as we want, as immoral as we want, because the market will work it out. And that's really the basis of capitalism. So capitalism, there's no way that capitalism can be supported by the Bible. But socialism, certain kinds of socialism, you know, we're not talking about any kind of authoritarianism or anything like that, but democratic socialism is much more in tune with biblical ethics. I'm not saying biblical ethics are socialist ethics. I mean, that's anachronistic, but the ethics are much more in tune with the ethical vision of, the moral vision of social democracy.
Is there a struggle then going on, say, in the ranks of committed Christians between those who are more inspired by the early Jesus before Constantine, by the commitment to the poor, by the commitment to egalitarianism and shared responsibility, by a government whose size and function is to be measured according to ethical rules and norms? Mm-hmm. Is there a struggle between those kinds of Christians and those who endorse capitalism, endorse the status quo, want to be part of a conservative coalition mm-hmm. in which business interests and socially conservative interests help each other? Mm. Is there a war going on inside modern Christianity between these alternatives? And if so, how's that going? Mm-hmm. How the two mm-hmm. sides shape mm-hmm. up? Mm-hmm. Where do you see that mm-hmm. moving mm-hmm. in the world today?
Well, there's not a lot of, there's some struggle, but it's not really a war.
Okay.
Because the domination and hegemony are in control. But with Constantine, well, with post-Constantinian Christianity, what we saw with Constantine, the focus was on what you believed, not what you did. Okay, it was the measure was, do you believe this? Do you confess this particular tenet? And on down the line. The measure of Jesus is what you do. In fact, what's it? Matthew 25, the primary mode of judgment that Jesus gives, whether you're going to go to heaven or go to hell, is whether you help the poor and the needy. And he says, if you feed the needy, if you clothe the naked, you give, you know, drink to the thirsty, then you will go to heaven. And but if you don't do that, you'll go to the left hand of God, which is hell. Very very, very specific, very, very, very clear. But we don't see it read this way at all in mainstream Christianity. Then we have this prosperity gospel, which is just it's just blasphemy. I mean, really, because it takes capitalist selfishness to a whole nother point. And so we see some liberation theologians. We see a generation of theologians starting to understand the Bible in its own context, but still quite a minority. And, you know, we're reviled because we're more concerned about what Jesus was concerned about, making sure that that the very weakest of us are most vulnerable are taken care of, and the forces and institutions that that prey upon them and companies that prey upon them are that they're sort of put in check. But they attack us because that's our concern more so than, you know, do you believe in this doctrine? Do you believe in that doctrine, the other doctrine? And the doctrines, Jesus, you can't trace most of those doctrines back to Jesus. I mean, really, he didn't say to worship him. He didn't say that. He said to worship God. I mean, he didn't say that they're the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost are one. If you don't believe that, you're going to hell. I mean, there's a mistranslation in the King James Bible in the first John's first letter. They mistranslated a phrase that says the water, the blood, and the spirit are in agreement, and was translated the Father, Son, the Holy Ghost. And they don't want to hear this. So there'll be conservative listeners listening to me right now who will just ignore what I'm saying. I mean, if they don't even care to go to the text to see if it's true or not. They are wed to what they believe. So what we have is ideological Christians who read Christianity in terms of their own interests. That's what we see with the religious right. They align themselves with Republicans, and as we know, the Republican Party has always stood against every policy, historically, maybe one or two they haven't, every policy that primarily benefited the little people and the poor people.
Yeah, the irony is what comes to my mind, and I've been a critic of President Obama, as people who listen to the program know, but that when he has occasionally supported a policy that Republicans didn't like, one of the attacks on him was he's interested in redistributing the wealth. And you've just given us several examples in which Jesus admonishes his followers to do exactly that. Mm-hmm. And yet the attack on Obama is as if redistributing the wealth is some foreign, immoral, anti-Christian affirmation. It gives you a sense of how folks like you within the world of biblical studies and of Christian theology have your work cut out for you to fight that battle.
No question. And it's not just Jesus. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, it's the exact same thing. And yeah, we have our work cut out for it. Ideological Christianity, it rules the day. And as long as it rules the day, we will not see churches really stand up and do what they are supposed to do to fight for the little people and make sure that the income inequality and wealth and poverty inequality gap is lessened. And it will get worse if we don't stop it, because they say that God is on their side, so they can do whatever they want, because God, I mean Adam Smith, I mean the invisible hand, will make sure everything works out. Blasphemy, and it's stupid.
Aubrey, thanks very much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
That was an excerpt from the series Economic Update with host Richard Wolff speaking with author and professor Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, Jr. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9:57. Coming up at 10 o'clock here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill recorded at the recent Socialism Conference and a look at the inside story of the Pentagon Papers. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter looks at actions taking place in the Pacific Northwest to confront climate crisis with David Osborne of Portland Rising Tide, Tori Cole with 350 PDX's campaign divestment team, and Bonnie McKinley, who works on climate issues with Power Past Coal, Rising Tide, Greenpeace, 350 PDX, and the Sierra Club.
The first annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance? Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot radio show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
The time is 10 o'clock straight up, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.